Mike Butterick was elected to Parliament at the 2023 general election. He had a first crack at it in 2020 and just missed out thanks to the red wave and Kieran McNulty there in the Wairarapa. But this time around, he's made it into Parliament, and from what we've seen so far, he's been a true champion of rural New Zealand. So, Mike Butterick, welcome to Taxpayer Talk.
Yeah, how are you, Connor?
Oh, fantastic. Thanks for taking the time to join us today. The first thing I wanted to start with is we'll go back, I won't say a fair way, but a way to your childhood. Can you tell us a bit about, you know, your upbringing? Was it on a farm? What was your childhood like? And what were the kind of experiences you had that shaped you into who you are today?
Well, good question, Connor. It's going back a little bit further than probably some of the other MPs, just quietly. So, yeah, I grew up on a family farm just inland from Ashburton, and we had 1,000 acres irrigated, and it was a fattening farm. And, you know, as rural kids do, you're very much a farm hand. And so we obviously all helped on the farm and loved it. And, you know, that was the start of my passion for the farming sector or agriculture in general, and it's something that I've always managed to be able to do.
Yeah, so you said you worked in farming for a bit and then eventually, you know, purchased your own farm. When did you start actually working? What kind of decade was it that you were working on the farm post-school?
Yeah, probably, well, preschool, probably the day I could walk, but yep. Post-school, I left school at the end of the sixth form.
Yep.
And I had three working dogs before them, which I'd broken in at home during the school holidays. And so I left school, worked at one of the feedlots in South Canterbury for a bit, and then actually went up to the Nationals Polar Cross Finals in Taupo and got offered a job in the Wairarapa Shepherding. Oh, so that was 1990, I went up there
yep.
and mustered at Wairere, New Zealand's premier biggest sheep stud. And then I met my wife there at the same time, and she joined the police force, got posted up to Waira. And so we obviously both moved up there. So beautiful part of the country up there. Brilliant stock work and great, great people. Really loved our time up there. So worked from Waira right up as far as Hicks Bay, inland from Hicks Bay. And before we came back and bought our farm in 95 in the Wairarapa.
Oh, fantastic. Sounds great. And I love that part of the world as well.
Yeah.
So the reason I ask is I imagine when you really started to go out on your own in farming, it would have been following the reforms of Roger Douglas, where a lot of the agricultural subsidies were taken away, the economy was opened up. Did that affect you at all, or what was your experience with that?
Not particularly. We bought our farm in 95, and it was one of the toughest farms in the Wairarapa. It was called Rocky Hills for a very good reason. It was full of rocks, and it was probably priced accordingly. And we were very, very young buying our farm, and it was just a massive opportunity. So we lived on the smell of an oily rag for a long, long time, but we had a really great life farming as well because we loved it. We were living our dream.
So I see you've also been involved with Federated Farmers. What kind of moved you from being just a farmer and someone who enjoyed rural New Zealand to enjoying, you know, wanting to be an advocate for farmers?
Yeah, good question. And I take a very strong view that you can only sit back in the corner and say nothing for so long. And I think, and I mentioned it in my maiden speech, you're either at the table or you're on it, and it is not much fun being part of the menu. So, and I think this role that I've got now, Connor, I've got this opportunity to speak up on behalf of the people I've spent my life with. And that's not just the farming community, that's all the people in provincial New Zealand.
Yeah, so I listened to your maiden speech. I thought it was very good. But you talked a lot about all the environmental work that farmers have been doing, where it almost seems like a lot of the negativity or dairy farmers being too scared to say what their job is, or kids getting bullied because their parents are farmers. Why don't you think rural New Zealand is getting the recognition for the, you know, the thousands of kilometres of fencing and native plantings and things like that?
Yeah, and that's a very good question and quite a complex question as well. I think we're not very good at articulating what we've done in a public manner. By our very nature, we're quite individualistic. We're very reserved. We don't shout our deeds out from the rooftops. But that is the cold, hard facts. And I always say the farmers are probably more environmental than anybody else in New Zealand. And that's borne out by the kilometres of waterways fenced off, the 2.8 million hectares of woody vegetation on our farms, the 5,000th QE2 covenant being registered last year, actually, in the Wairarapa. All the catchment board plantings over the previous decades and retiring of gullies, etc. So, mark my words, rural New Zealand has invested a lot in the environment. And I always say it's a reciprocal arrangement that we have as farmers between our land, our family and our business.
So, outside of farming, you've had a bit of community involvement. Wings over Wairarapa springs to mind. How did you get involved in that? And for those listeners that don't know what it is, maybe tell us a bit about it and whether it's worth visiting your region to see.
Yeah, look, you've absolutely got to go. Every 2 years, so it's an aviation event on a Saturday, Sunday. And on the Friday, actually, we have what we call it used to be STEM. Now it's STEAM Day for the kids. And we have 5,000 school children there. So it's anything to do with the aviation industry. And it's just a fantastic event, and it puts Wairarapa firmly on the map. And we actually have the largest collection of working World War I planes flying there, and you can't see that anywhere in the world other than in Masterton. And so why did I get involved? Because I could contribute, and that's the view I take. Why wouldn't you?
So are you a history buff, or you like engineering, or why planes specifically over another community organisation?
Oh, no, not necessarily planes, or probably none of those things you mentioned. I'm just very minded about community events, and if I can help, I can. And I like contributing, and I don't mind getting a bit of dirt under my fingernails. Roll up the sleeves and get into it and help. And I come back to, why wouldn't you? If you can, help. Because our communities have been built on people that actually contribute. And one of the real privileges of this job that I've got now is I get to go around and witness the things that people do in our communities. And it's something that's always been very, very strong in our rural and provincial communities. And those community good organisations really are the glue that stick us all together.
Fantastic. So I previously, as a guest on the podcast, we had Andrew Hoggard, who is also part of Federated Farmers. You've both had a lot of community involvement. You're big in the rural sector. You've ended up in two different parties. What led you to the National Party as opposed to the ACT Party? And what are your values that you see both in yourself and in the National Party?
Yeah, good question, Connor. The National Party, it's a shared set of values, I think, and I always talk about those values, and I refer to them in my maiden speech as well, personal responsibility, and less government, not more. And I take a very firm view that government's role is actually to create problems. I'll wind that back. It's to solve problems and not create them. And it really is get the settings right, get the rules right, the legislation right, so that people can just get out of bed, go and live their lives as uninterrupted as possible. And I'm really firm in that being one of the disciplines that government should display. Strong families, caring communities, those values actually resonate because those values are my values, and I say those values are my community's values as well.
Absolutely. And so the National Party is, even though you're united by some of those common values, it's quite a broad church. You've got people, I think it's a good thing. You don't want everyone group thinking. You've got people from a range of different backgrounds and ranging from more of the social progressives or more of socially conservative, but kind of underpinning that seems to be a common thread of fiscal conservatism. Where do you see yourself on that kind of social spectrum?
Oh, look, I'm probably not too big on putting a label on myself as such. I can be very fiscally conservative. You know, certainly be a farmer when you get challenged. Every dollar is a prisoner. And I think that's one of the things that we've witnessed with the previous government is the appalling lack of respect in terms of fiscal spending. And it's just been wastage. And I just think it's not okay. But in terms of coming back to your question, in terms of where I label myself and the different views from within the party, I think that's healthy, very, very healthy. And diversity of thought, and I think you've only got to go back and listen to the maiden speeches and see and listen to the diversity of lived experience. And that's something I'm really big on as well, lived experience. You get out in the real world, you spend your own money, you take your own risks, you build your business or do whatever you do, and you bring all that experience back to this place, which creates far more diverse and healthy thinking.
Absolutely, absolutely. Now, just changing tack slightly, in your maiden speech, you threw a few jabs across the house at the other side, how they're always, you know, they talked a lot about like inequality, wealth inequality and things like that, but didn't, in your view, speak very much about education.
Yes.
And I could tell from your speech you're very passionate about education and see that as, you know, one of the best ladders to help people up out of poverty and into success in the real world. So can you tell me a bit about why does education matter to you and where would you like to see it going in the country?
I think in terms of our education, they're our kids. They're our children. And I'm father of four kids as well, and so got a very good sense of how important school is. I just find it appalling that in amongst all this talk of inequality and injustice and stuff like that, education has not been mentioned once, because surely education has to be one of the best pathways out of poverty, one of the best pathways into employment, one of the best pathways into being independent rather than dependent. And when we've only got to look at our job seeker numbers, and when we correlate that with the literacy overlay, that the literacy accomplishments or achievements or lack thereof with that as well, and it's not their fault. Be very clear about that. It's never the kids' fault. There's just been a fundamental lack of focus on the importance of education, and the statistics bear that out. Now, we have two choices. We can either, as I say, we can roll our eyes and gnash our teeth and stamp our feet and make a lot of noise and do nothing about it, but we need to actually right this ship, because it's not okay. These kids have one chance at an education, only one. And when they're out of the education system, it's too late if we haven't done what we need to do. And I just think we've got to front foot that. We absolutely have to, and it's not their fault.
Fantastic. So one thing that stood out to me was you talked about a local school in your area that had trialled a new program and it had been really successful in improving the outcomes for the kids. And you talked about local solutions for nationwide problems. Is that kind of part of your political philosophy and kind of supporting devolution to local communities and allowing them and empowering them to solve their own problems rather than centralising it in Wellington and saying, you know, bureaucrats know best?
Absolutely. Big brother is not always right, and more often than not is not right. And I think about that success of that program, this is a particular school that's probably ranked in terms of social deprivation, one of the worst ranked schools in the Greater Wellington region. And they had some very challenging attendance figures, and a couple of individuals and two particular principals formed their own program, funded it out of their own pocket, and the turnaround in attendance has been absolutely stunning. And because you had local people out knocking on doors, making phone calls, rather than a big bureaucratic beast that was covering a whole a geographical area that was probably 100 times that size, and just sending an email every now and again, Johnny's not at school. And so I think absolutely it comes back to the community, because we all know each other.
Absolutely. And so talking to those kind of local solutions and things like that. You've got one of the largest electorates in the country. How do you plan to be able to be across all the issues and that wide geographic spread? And are you there to listen or to help implement changes, or what do you see your role as an electorate MP?
My role fundamentally is to go in and listen and engage with people. That's it. It's and listen to their issues, but also importantly to kind of listen to their solutions, because I'm a very firm believer that local people understand their issues, and so by default they spend all their time thinking about the solutions. So you actually only need to engage and listen to them. And when I say listen, I mean actually listen. Don't go through the motions of listening. Listen properly. And my ears certainly aren't just glued to my head. They're not ornaments. And I think you're right in terms of the electorate. We have 5 district councils. We have 3 regional councils. It's just under 12,000 square kilometres. And just by the sheer size of it, it takes a long time to get from A to B to C. That's just the reality of it. We'll have offices centrally, probably one in Masterton and in CHB and the Tararua district as well. So you just spread yourself out as far as you can. But I think the really important thing that I'm very keen on doing is, and I think we've seen this with the previous government, is the complete disconnection between this place in Wellington and people out at the coalface. So I think there's 2 things I think about there. One of the really important things to decide is to actually go and listen to advice, but the key part of that is deciding who to ask for the advice. And so that is about building a network of people throughout that whole electorate, CHB, Tararua and Wairarapa, that you trust to tell you what's happening, that won't tell you what they think you want to hear, that will tell you what you need to hear. And there is a fundamental difference.
Absolutely. And I guess now you're on the other side of the table, being involved with Federated Farmers previously, where you were one of those people telling the government or politicians what they need to hear. You've also been involved with an organisation called 50 Shades of Green. Had to make sure I say that properly.
You get the last word right.
Yeah, absolutely. So can you tell me a bit about that and how you got involved with that, and What did 50 Shades of Green advocate for, and why was it important?
Yeah, it was the 50 Shades of Green, I think, and that's probably started the pathway that got me here, because I can assure you, being an MP was never part of my career path, was never even entered my mind. And so we were just seeing this huge increase of good farmland going into forestry. And these were farms in the Wairarapa, Pongaroa. Some of these farms were Hill Country Farms of the Year. They were very, very good farms. And so, and bear in mind, our old farm, that was a particularly tough farm, that went to trees, but quite a bit prior to that, that went sold to trees in 2015, after 6 years on the market. We tried for 4 years, Brian Hoare, Mayor Ron Mark, Fran Wild, we tried for 4 years to turn that into a regional park, and we just couldn't do it. So the distinction I make, there are some country, whether I like to admit it or not, that is better off in trees. But we were seeing beautiful farms going. And so what we did is we looked at why. And it was the political settings at the time that were providing a financial incentive to the forestry sector or the carbon sector that was over and above anything that any other competing sectors could access. So it was skewing the scrum. And so it was about that, and it was gathering momentum as well. And so we effectively started a lobby group, 50 Shades of Green. And I think what we did learn out of that, and I guess the question is, how successful were we? Because not all lobby groups managed to get their messaging across, is we were very consistent with our messaging. We stuck to the facts, and we were persistent. And I think that's the key thing, has been very persistent.
So to wrap things up, thank you very much for joining us on Taxpayer Talk. That was Mike Butterick, farmer, farming advocate, rural hero, and soon-to-be member of the Taxpayers Union.
Yeah, it's been a pleasure, Connor.
Thank you very much.